I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. This show is about the richness of life. Thank you for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. The average American consumes the equivalent of 15 5-pound bags of sugar every year. We know sugar makes us fat and can lead to type 2 diabetes and heart disease. It's also been linked to other serious health issues, poor brain function, and even cataracts. My guest, Dr. Patricia Ferris, will tell you sugar is more addictive than cocaine, and it's making us fat, lazy, and ugly. Dr. Patricia Ferris is a clinical associate professor at Tulane University and a distinguished member of the skin faculty at the American Academy of Dermatology. She's written articles that have appeared in the New York Times, Allure, and Good Housekeeping magazine. She's also co-authored this book with nutritionist Brooke Alpert called The Sugar Detox, and it's now out in paperback. We're talking with her today from her home in Louisiana. Patricia Ferris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Why is sugar bad for us?
You know, it's such a complex question, but the reality of it is that the amount of added sugar in our diets now is just through the roof. And what sugar does is complex, but the obesity that is caused by sugar is really the problem. That causes you to increase your blood sugar levels, so you get instability of blood sugar levels that triggers insulin to be produced. Eventually, you develop insulin resistance. This, of course, is why people who eat a lot of sugar end up with type 2 diabetes. And then insulin resistance also causes a host of other problems or is associated with a host of other problems, such as heart disease, high levels of cholesterol and triglycerides, and all of these are really believed to be due to the excessive amount of sugar that we're eating.
Hmm. Here's how the book's laid out. You start with quitting sugar cold turkey for 3 days. Then there are recommendations about what foods to avoid, as well as what foods you can have, some steps to caring for your skin in conjunction with an exercise program, and then some recipes in the back. And the diet is broken into a 4-week plan. So let's walk through the 3-day sugar fast. You say no dairy, no fruit except for lemons and limes. And why lemons and limes?
Well, lemons and limes have lots of polyphenols in them, and they're not very sugary. So they have good antioxidants in them, and we use them primarily as garnish for water and fruits and vegetables and the like. So they're not high in sugar.
And no wheat or starches or added sugars, obviously. Why do we need to start with a fast?
Well, because of the fact that sugar is so addicting, unfortunately. So we tried to figure out something that was easy to do. We figured anybody could do it for 3 days. And we wanted to clear the palate. What happens on the sugar detox, and I want to start by saying we've had tremendous success, Brooke treating her clients, me using this with patients, with weight loss. Tremendous success. And I give her all the credit on the diet itself. She's a crackerjack nutritionist, and she really put together a very healthy, nutritious, easy-to-use diet plan. But what happens when you clear your palate of that sweet, sweet flavor that you're so used to is that you begin to appreciate the sweetness in other things. In week one, we actually begin to give back natural sugars. We give back one serving of dairy, which has lactose, and that's a sugar. We also give apples. An apple has never tasted so sweet after that 3 days. Incredible. Almonds. You begin to taste the natural sweetness in things that you never realized were sweet. So we learned a lot. You know, that clearing the palate really made a difference in the way people reacted to the foods that we gave them.
I noticed on the list of no-nos, you specifically mentioned quinoa as a food to stay away from. I know you're not on the nutrition side of it necessarily, but I thought quinoa was one of those healthy grains full of protein.
Well, you know, later quinoa comes back in. So initially we do keep people off of all of those things, but we do bring it in later.
You also offer advice in the book on what foods to order when you're eating out and how you can combine treats with certain foods that burn sugar so you aren't completely deprived. How does combining foods work?
Well, you know, combining foods is important because we studied a lot of not just what was bad in foods, so we didn't just take away bad foods with sugars and processed grains and the like. We wanted to add in things that were healthy. So you'll notice throughout the 4-week program that we begin to add in a lot of spices that have different ingredients in them that can actually inhibit glycation. So we started studying glycation inhibiting compounds like resveratrol in wine. People are like, wow, I can drink some wine on this. Well, we give you the lowest sugar wine, and that's red wine. White wine is higher in sugar. And red wine is very high in resveratrol, which is a anti-glycating polyphenol. They have anti-diabetic activity, these polyphenolic antioxidants. So we very carefully thought about not just what we took out of the sugar detox, but what we put in.
This is Dr. Patricia Ferris. She's a clinical associate professor at Tulane University and has co-authored this book, The Sugar Detox. There's a quick multiple choice quiz at the beginning of the book to help you determine if you're addicted to sugar, which I did take.
Are you a sugar addict?
Unfortunately, I really am.
Okay.
I did go off sugar for a while. And then after about 2 weeks of basically no sugar, I had a glass of wine and experienced this wave of exhaustion come over me pretty quickly. Was that related to my sugar intake?
Could it be sugar? Sure. Could it be, the ethanol itself? It could make you exhausted as well. But the one thing that you're correct about is one of the things that people say to us right away is their energy level bounces really high when they get off of the sugar. Because, we talk in the beginning of the book of the highs and the lows of the sugar high. You're only high on sugar for a short time. It gets metabolized up and then boom, you get that sugar crash. So when you start to level out your blood sugar levels and level out your insulin levels, that's when you start to feel better. We also had lots of people who had inflammatory diseases like arthritis and things like that. They start feeling better because the other thing that's come to light is that sugar's it triggers inflammation in the body, and that's probably one of the worst things it does to you. So when that inflammation starts to rev up, again, you start feeling bad. Mm. So there's no question that taking sugar out of the diet is going to make you feel better.
You also talk in the book about when, how, and which foods to eat together. What is it about when we eat and how we eat?
Well, I think the when we eat is, to some extent, it's people are habitual about the way they eat and when they eat. So we tried to make it so that people were eating throughout the day so that they were not letting themselves get hungry. That sometimes is the villain. When you reach for the wrong thing is when you're starving. It's invariably when you'll go for a bag of chips or, a bad carbohydrate, or you just stick something sweet in your mouth. So we try to keep people eating throughout the day for that reason.
You mentioned some of the negative health effects sugar can have, such as heart disease and type 2 diabetes. I also read in your book that sugar is linked to cataracts and Alzheimer's.
Well, that's another thing that sugar does. And what sugar does, in addition to causing some of these metabolic problems, or what we call as physicians a metabolic syndrome, it also, when it's circulating around in the blood at high levels, it has to go somewhere. Some of it, of course, gets stored in the liver. That's why people who eat a lot of sugar get non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, because it gets converted into fat in the liver. But other amounts of sugar get attached to protein molecules. And this is a process called glycation. And when glycation occurs in protein molecules, it causes something called advanced glycation end products. And these are the culprits in things like heart disease, kidney disease we see in diabetics. Alzheimer's disease is believed to be, again, at least partly due to these advanced glycation end products.
And those are also the things that affect your skin?
Exactly. So a lot of people have asked me, you're a dermatologist, why are you writing a book on sugar? And I've spent my whole career, I've been a dermatologist for 30 years, studying skin aging and, on the contrary, ways that we can stop skin aging, because this is what people come to me for my expertise in. And I realized very recently that we have a huge, void in our ability to counsel patients on nutrition as it relates to dermatology. Whereas, in things like heart disease and other medical problems, they use nutrition all the time, and they do, don't eat this, eat that. This is better for you if you have high blood pressure. This is better if you have heart disease. But in dermatology, we weren't making these recommendations to our patients. About 10 years ago, things came into the literature that related high glycemic index diets with acne. And for years, as dermatologists, we were telling patients, oh, you're breaking out. You're not breaking out because of the foods. We had done the studies that proved it was not happening. But lo and behold, as science does and time evolves, there were studies coming into the literature that very succinctly showed that kids who ate diets loaded with sugar and processed foods had more acne. Why is that? Well, what it does is it turns on some of the hormonal cascade that causes acne. And so it's not just directly the sugar itself, it's the things that sugar does in the body that make it dangerous.
So sugar can cause acne as well as premature aging.
Absolutely. So advanced glycation end products, which we talked about, those protein molecules that get glycated, also occur in the skin. The two most important molecules in your skin are collagen and elastin. Collagen, of course, keeps the skin plump, and elastin gives it its elasticity. When sugar molecules attach to that, those two proteins, they cause glycated collagen and glycated elastin to be deposited within the skin. So all of a sudden your skin doesn't have its snap anymore because the elastin molecules are ineffective, and it also begins to wrinkle because as collagen molecules get glycated, they become dysfunctional basically.
So it's causing your skin to both sag and wrinkle?
Correct. So we started looking at the role of nutrition in skin aging and how we could counsel patients who were motivated to continue to look young and to, you know, live a healthy life, how we could connect the dots between nutrition and aging. And I've actually been lecturing on this quite extensively around the country. I'm speaking at the World Congress of Dermatology in early June on the subject, and that's going to be up in Canada. So I'm excited about giving the talk, and we get a great response from the physicians because, again, we're really just starting to connect the dots.
Are all sugars created equal?
Well, sugars that you put in your coffee and the high fructose corn syrup that we have in so many of our processed foods are probably the main culprits. But a lot of people get lured into thinking, well, I'm not going to use sugar, table sugar. I'm going to go to honey. Well, honey's loaded with fructose. And quite frankly, fructose is also as bad as glucose. So we do have to be careful of substituting things that we think are safe, because they're not, again, just because they're natural like honey doesn't necessarily mean they don't do the same thing in your body, because they do.
So if you're a person who really enjoys sweet as opposed to savory, are artificial sweeteners an acceptable alternative?
You know, artificial sweeteners have unfortunately been condemned in the same way that sugar has. Artificial sweeteners trick your brain into thinking that you eat sugar. They actually cause absorption of sugar to be enhanced, so they make you absorb more sugar. And they've shown that people who drink things like diet drinks actually become more obese. And they don't totally understand why that is, but at least to some extent, it's just because when people are not drinking sugar in a soft drink, they're going to take that sugar in somewhere else. And then again, the body's, the hormonal cascade that occurs when you eat sugar, much of that occurs when you eat sweeteners too. So we had to make a decision very early on in the sugar detox that we were going to say no to sweeteners of any kind.
We're talking with Dr. Patricia Ferris about this book she co-authored with nutritionist Brooke Alpert. It's called The Sugar Detox. We've been discussing some of the effects that sugar has on our health and how to change our sugar habits. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. We're going to take a quick break now and then continue our conversation with Patricia Ferris. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith. Wanted to let you know about Faith Middleton's Food Schmooze Martini Competition. Statewide bartenders will shake up innovative martinis, and you vote for the Food Schmooze Martini champion. There's a designated driver discount, great top chef noshes, and a sizzling DJ. It all happens Thursday, June 25th, 6 p.m. at Simsbury's Riverview. Thanks to Power Station Events. Tickets are $60. Order now at ctmartini.org. We're talking about the book The Sugar Detox with co-author Dr. Patricia Ferris. It's based on a 4-week plan that starts with a 3-day sugar detox program. We've learned about some of the serious negative effects sugar can have on our health, as well as causing things like premature aging of the skin and acne. The book includes a skin regimen, an exercise program, 50 recipes, and meal plans. The Sugar Detox is now out in paperback. You say it's important to eat breakfast and that breakfast skippers are more likely to gain weight. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, the studies have shown that people who don't eat early in the morning tend to have heavier intake later in the day. Of course, your level of exercise and everything as the day goes on, you start getting more tired. You come home, you sit on the sofa, you eat a huge meal, and then you go right to bed. So they really feel like it increases your metabolism early in the day and gives you that get up and go that you need. And again, you're not starving by the time you get to lunch when you might make some poor choices.
You say sugar consumption is at an all-time high, and scientists from the University of California recommend that it be regulated like alcohol and tobacco.
It's probably not for me to comment on legislation and how we should handle sugar, but I think what we wanted to do was to enlighten people and to explain to them in the simplest of terms, and I hope that we've done that in the introduction, what sugar does to you and why you need to control your intake of sugar. And I really do feel, you know, that those who have read the book and those who understand it find it, again, very easy to stay on because we're not taking everything away from people. You know, these diets that are so restrictive, I mean, we've all tried to do them. But at the end of the day, you know, you do need some carbohydrates for fuel. Your muscles need carbohydrates. I mean, people without carbohydrates are like cars without gas. So we teach people what whole grains they can eat and what things they can eat that will give them that energy they need, but not give them that quick burst and, you know, again, that drop in blood sugar that occurs when you eat processed carbohydrates.
I mentioned in the introduction that, according to your book, sugar is more addictive than cocaine. Really?
Sugar is highly addicting. You know, it's incredible to me. I watch my grandchildren, who are little bitties, and if you put fruit on the table before you give them their grilled chicken and vegetables, they literally will go for that fruit every single time. I mean, you know, people, it's so incredible, you know, from the mouth of babes. We literally have to put it aside or tell the waitress not to bring it to allow them to enjoy the rest of the meal before they go for that. They want the sweet. I think we're almost born addicted to it. I mean, that flavor, whatever it is, it's so good that even a child will preferentially pick it over, you know, a French fry, for example, which is pretty yummy, as we all know. But they'll pick that fruit every time. They will pick the fruit every single time.
And you do say that in the book, that we have this natural preference for the taste of sugar from birth. And studies have indicated that a lot of children prefer sweet over salt, even as they are aging. So how do we deal with this problem, do you think, knowing what it can lead to when we're trying to teach our kids about food choices?
It's very difficult. And, you know, we have to be somewhat realistic about life and lifestyles. And, you know, that's why we spent some time doing the restaurant guide and also shop. There's lots of shopping lists in the book that make it very easy for mothers who are working and raising their kids to go and, you know, find the things they need that are healthy and that they can use for the recipes. We actually have an iPhone app for the sugar detox as well, which is very helpful. If you're in the grocery store, you can, you know, pop the app open. It's got all the recipes in it. And we tried to make it easy. I mean, I'd be lying if I said every once in a while that you shouldn't treat your kid to something, you know, it's a birthday cake or it's something else. But we give in the book ways that you can sort of trade those things out for another serving of carbohydrate. And I think with kids, what I'm seeing is way different than when I was raising my kids. You know, my children are very conscious about sugar and their kids, and, you know, they don't like them having sugar. They, you know, the behavioral change is so dramatic when they do it. Their energy level goes up and they get so difficult to deal with that, you know, they just don't indulge them in the way that we truthfully indulged our kids. We didn't know any better. We thought fat was the enemy when my kids were growing up.
Right. My guest is Dr. Patricia Ferris. She's a clinical associate professor at Tulane University and has co-authored this book, The Sugar Detox. And you just mentioned that you'd give advice in the book about what to order when you go out. Let's give some examples of that. That was a really helpful section of the book.
Well, you know, probably one of the hardest places to go out to eat for me is a Mexican restaurant. Number one, because I literally love everything on the menu, and I could live my whole life without sweets, but I am a carbohydrate addict. So I'm the opposite of you, but we have the same problem, you know. So at the end of the day, it's all of those types of things that make it so hard in a Mexican restaurant. But, you know, going for the fajitas, skipping the margarita, unfortunately, because those are just so bad for you and so loaded with sugar. But, you know, going for some of those things that are, you know, more of the veggie platform and the meats, which they have wonderful things if you scour through the menu in a Mexican restaurant. It's really easy to go Japanese, of course. I mean, nowadays we almost never eat sushi that doesn't have brown rice on it. So you can do all of the sashimis, the sushi that has brown rice on it. So that makes a very easy restaurant choice. And in American restaurants now, I think they're really more conscious about giving healthier options too. So, you know, doing the chicken salads instead of the chicken sandwich on a bun and, you know, that kind of thing. We unfortunately as a culture have to catch up to the science, and that's always where, you know, the rubber has to meet the road, is when the culture really starts to turn. And I give a lot of credit to, you know, a lot of the diets that came before us that actually pioneered the way to helping the restaurant industry and some of these people in the food service industry to help us to have healthier choices. And, you know, if you really look at the menu, you can make healthy choices.
So what do you order at the Mexican restaurant?
I usually do fajitas now. And I don't wrap them up in, you know, anything. So I'll do just a fajita, which is usually loaded with veggies and green peppers and red peppers and that, and then just the meat sizzled, and it's delicious. And it has whatever that Mexican food flavor is that I love, it has that flavor. But it doesn't have all the bad carbohydrates that unfortunately go with it, the corn tortillas or the white flour tortillas, which, again, I would rather eat than a cupcake any day of the week.
There's a skin regimen in this book, and I know this is really your area. If you could only do one thing, what should it be?
Well, I'll say if you could do one thing to help your skin age more slowly, it would be to eat clean and stop sugar binging. I mean, you know, I talk to women all day long, and they come in to me, and they want lasers and chemical peels and Botox and fillers, and I'm happy to do them, but unlike, you know, many physicians, I spend the time talking to them about their nutrition. And it's shocking what, especially a mom on the go, you know, is running through the Dunkin' Donuts line. And again, I'd love a Dunkin' Donut, but, you know, they're running through the donut shop, or they're running through the fast food line because they're so busy and they're making such bad choices. And I'm like, listen, you know, all the work I can do with my hands is not going to stop what you're doing by eating the wrong foods. So I think I really have adopted a more holistic approach to the way I treat patients with skin aging. And obviously you have to stop sun exposure and lots of other bad, bad things for your skin. But I think as far as products go, if you ask 10 dermatologists, I would almost bet that 9 of them would tell you a vitamin A cream is probably the best cream you can put on your skin. Vitamin A has more benefits to the skin than almost anything. And it's been so well tested and so well used and adopted by dermatologists that we just understand how it affects the biology of the skin. It boosts collagen production. It can lighten the skin. It can certainly soften lines and wrinkles. We've seen that in all of the great studies that were done years ago on Retin-A and the various forms of Retin-A. So if you ask a dermatologist, almost every one of us uses some form of Retin-A. It can be a retinol, so it doesn't have to be a prescription form. There's lots of great over-the-counter retinols, but Retin-A. And then the second, number two, would be antioxidants during the day. And we talk a lot about that in the book. It's part of our daytime skin regimen. These are photoprotectors, so they prevent you from getting sun damage during the day. And they also inhibit glycation, especially if they have things in them like green tea extract or pomegranate extract or resveratrol. So the fruit and vegetable extracts do have lots of polyphenols in them that can inhibit glycation.
And there are a lot of books out there about detoxing from sugar. But tell me, what's different about this one?
Well, I think the combination approach between the nutrition and the skin is sort of a fresh approach to the subject of sugar. You can't turn the TV on right now without seeing something about sugar and the dangers of sugar. So I think that, again, science has caught up, mass media has caught up. We're getting that message out of there. But, you know, I learned a long time ago when we started trying to get people out of the sun that they were not all that scared about getting skin cancer. But when I'd show them pictures of how old some of these women looked on Miami Beach, for example, mm-hmm. they would be like, oh! And I really think that sometimes what motivates us is perhaps more about our appearance and more about the way we age than, you know, again, if you tell a 17-year-old kid who's going in a tanning bed she's going to get skin cancer, she's just going to laugh at you. They don't care at that age. But, you know, when I tell a teenager, look, you need to quit eating candy because it's giving you pimples. I mean, trust me, they quit eating candy. And the parents are like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe that. But, you know, as soon as you tell them something like that, I mean, they're highly motivated. You know, kids are 80% of American kids get acne. It's devastating to the kids who have it. Even though everybody has it, they're devastated by it. I mean, it's really a psychological impact on the child. And if I tell them, listen, you clean your diet up, you get the junk food out, you get the chips out, you get the white bread out, you get all the candy out, they literally will clean up their diets. And, of course, their face improves. So it's amazing how appearance can actually motivate people to do things that are healthy for them.
No kidding. My guest is Dr. Patricia Ferris. She's a clinical associate professor at Tulane University and has co-authored this book, The Sugar Detox. Have you been able to clear up a case of acne in a teenager without medication, just strictly through diet?
You know, those studies have been done. In practice, of course, you're going to use a combination approach of medications, diet intervention, stress relief, you know, especially in adult females, stress is a huge trigger for acne. So we would rarely use something in a void, even medicine in a void without the others. But the studies that were done actually did dietary interventions without medication. And they took kids and they cleaned their diets up and they, you know, gave half of them a good diet and the other ones continued to eat the junk and the sugars. And the kids who went on the better diet had less acne. And, you know, those studies have all been, you know, they've been published in the literature now. It's interesting when you practice medicine long enough, things you told people 20 years ago, you know, you can't tell them anymore. We used to always tell parents, don't worry about what they're eating. They'd come in and go, they're eating all this chocolate. Well, the truth of it was probably the sugar in the candy. It probably wasn't the chocolate itself. Mm. But, you know, we didn't know that at the time, and they did studies on chocolate, and chocolate never panned out. So we would tell the mom, look, you know, we wish we could back you up on this one, but the studies don't support it. Now the studies have finally figured out it was actually the sugar.
Is it okay to have a cheat day, or does that lead you back down to the path of destruction?
You know, we don't really allow cheat days, but we, like I said, there's a way that Brooke has fit in if you want to have a cheat where you have a dessert and you take away one of your carbohydrate servings. So, you know, an occasional cheat, but the notion of I'm going to binge for an entire day is just like shooting yourself in the foot. I just feel like that sets you back too far.
Is that because you are doing damage at that moment, or is that because you're thinking that, well,
I think it increases your craving. I mean, I think you start to crave again. You know, it's like we don't tell alcoholics, well, you can only drink on Saturday.
Right.
I mean, you start craving again. And so, you know, just the whole notion that you can, you know, again, throw caution to the wind one day of the week just doesn't make sense.
I want to circle back to the health effects for a second. I read an article a while back that strongly suggested that sugar was a culprit in cancer.
And it is. And their studies have shown that it definitely increases your incidence of cancer. If you have a specific type of weight gain, which is that truncal obesity right around the midriff that occurs in people who overdo sugar. And it's not the sugar itself feeding the cancer cells. That's what people think, that, you know, sugar's the food that's making the cancer grow. It's the fact that that fat actually acts as an endocrine organ. It secretes a variety of hormones that actually can trigger and make cancers grow. So it's not the sugar itself. It's what the sugar does to the body, the fat, and then what the fat does to the cancer.
But if you have cancer, it must not be great to continue to eat the sugar, right?
Well, I don't think they've connected the dots in that way, so I don't think we can tell people if you have cancer and you eat sugar, your cancer's going to get worse. That I don't think is true. But I think that studies have shown that people with truncal obesity have a higher incidence of colon and rectal cancer, breast cancer. A variety of cancers are associated with that body type. So we know that that obesity, that mid-truncal obesity, is the type of obesity that predisposes people to developing a variety of cancers.
So I feel like we've talked a lot about the health effects, deprivation and, you know, not having fun, because I'm equating sugar with fun, of course. What's the good news?
The good news, and we hear it over and over again from patients and clients, is just how much better you will feel. I mean, when you feel better and your energy level is consistent throughout the day, you don't even know that you're feeling bad until you start feeling good, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
And that's what people tell us. They're like, I had no idea why I was dragging. But they were, again, those insulin levels bouncing all over and blood sugar going from one end to the other. It just, you're so much more even. Your temperament's so much more even. Your aches and pains get better. You know, on the three-day sugar detox, I put together a really pampering little skincare regimen, including, you know, sea salt baths and some antioxidant masks and some things that were really nice. And people start feeling better during those 3 days because they're taking care of themselves as well. There's something about self-awareness that I think we really miss in our busy, you know, hooked to the iPhone, hooked to the computer society, that when you start pampering yourself a little bit and really taking care of yourself, you start to feel better. You really do.
Well, this is an interesting book. Lots of information. Thank you for coming on the show.
You are more than welcome. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Dr. Patricia Ferris is co-author of The Sugar Detox. It's now out in paperback. Next, a conversation from the Faith Middleton Show archive about the little-known story of Thomas Jefferson and how he introduced French food in America. Thanks for listening.
Faith Middleton. Join the conversation with us on Twitter at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR, where you'll find our lineup of interesting guests for the week. Julia Child has been widely credited with bringing French food to America, but many people don't know that it was Thomas Jefferson, one of America's founding fathers and something of a foodie, who first introduced Americans to the haute cuisine of France. History paints Jefferson as a political philosopher, gardener, a naturalist, a bibliophile, but he was also a serious gourmand. Historian Thomas Crogwell explores this lesser-known side of Thomas Jefferson's life in his book, Thomas Jefferson's Creme Brulee, How a Founding Father and His Slave, James Hemings, Introduced French Food to America. And therein, the tale gets very interesting once we introduce Thomas Jefferson's slave into this story. My guest, Thomas Crogwell, is the author of several nonfiction books, including Stealing Lincoln's Body, which was adapted into a documentary by the History Channel. He lives in Bethel, Connecticut. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Faith. Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. So first explain, Thomas Jefferson has a slave, James Hemings. Tell us a little about him.
James Hemings, this is kind of complicated. James Hemings was a member of the most privileged slave family at Monticello because Hemings and his brothers and sisters were the half-brothers and sisters of Jefferson's wife. They were fathered by Jefferson's father-in-law. And when the father-in-law died, he left all of his slaves to Jefferson, including the Hemings family. So Jefferson owned seven of his in-laws.
Isn't that the most stunning fact?
Yes, but it was also very common right up until the end of slavery in 1865. Lots of masters had slave concubines and produced mixed-race children.
Yeah. So would you describe Jefferson as close to James Hemings, his slave?
Oh, yes. You know, the Hemings family always worked in the house. James Hemings was one of Jefferson's personal servants at Monticello, and then when they went to Paris, he was his personal servant there, too.
Right. So he says to James Hemings, if you will go to Paris with me, well, what was his bargain?
Well, the problem was that France, although it permitted slavery in its colonies, like Haiti, would not permit it in the mother country. So, well, the problem Jefferson was going to face was that the moment James got off the boat in France, he'd be a free man and there was nothing Jefferson could do about it. So as not to lose this slave, Jefferson made Hemmings an offer that if he trained as a French chef, came back to Monticello and trained another slave, then Jefferson would give James his freedom.
And what did James say in response?
Oh, he said yes. He took the offer.
He took the offer.
Well, okay. I think, you know, yes, he wanted his freedom, but then he would have been stuck in France. He'd never see his family again. So it was a tough decision, I'm sure.
Yeah. So off he goes.
Off he goes. They went over to Paris. They took Jefferson's oldest daughter with them. It's an eye-opening experience for both of these men. For example, in Virginia, Monticello is a palace, and Jefferson is an aristocrat. But now in Paris, they're seeing real palaces and real aristocrats, and Monticello now looks like an outbuilding, and Jefferson looks like a hick. In fact, one of the first things Jefferson did was he ordered himself an entirely new wardrobe because he realized he was seriously underdressed.
Was Thomas Jefferson a bit of a snob?
I wouldn't say that he was a snob. He was a little standoffish initially when he met people. But once you became Thomas Jefferson's friend, you were friends for life.
No, but I mean, if you go to a place where you see what you think is greater wealth, greater social standing, finer material goods than you have, and you think, well, I've got to acquire these things too. Doesn't that suggest to you, I mean, many people would come home and say, we're all just different.
Right. But Jefferson was working from two perspectives to answer that question. One, as a diplomat in France representing the United States, he had to make the Americans look good in front of the French. Secondly, he realized that, you know, America was still pretty rough around the edges at this point. And the Europeans had lots of stuff that could improve life in America. And so Jefferson, instead of collecting souvenirs, went around collecting things that would improve life in the United States. And this included food.
Yeah, I was going to say, what made Thomas Jefferson's food habits so different from the rest of his countrymen?
Well, for one thing, Americans in the 18th century were meat-obsessed. It was not unusual to have seven different courses of meat on the table at one time. Jefferson really didn't care very much for meat. He wasn't a vegetarian, but he used meat as a side dish. As a condiment, he used to say. And he really loved vegetables, which was also very unusual. Most Americans couldn't stand vegetables.
So this was personal taste.
It was personal taste. And then he gets to France, of course, and he's encountering things that he's never had in the United States, including olive oil, Parmesan cheese, truffles, pasta. They called it macaroni in those days. And then he has his first experience with champagne. There had never been champagne in the United States.
And he's in heaven.
He's in heaven. But although the champagne took a while, when he first tasted champagne, he jotted down in his notebook and he wrote down everything. After his first sip of champagne, he wrote, "Wine not good." Apparently the bubbles got to him. Later, though, he discovered that he really did like champagne and he brought quite a bit of it back with him.
Well, he was quite a wine guy.
Yes. Oh, huge wine guy. He made a grand tour of France and went to all the Grand Cru vineyards. And he made friends with connoisseurs, and they trained him how to select wines, and they were sending him wines to his house in Paris. And then when he went back to Virginia, they shipped wines back to him in the United States. During the War of 1812, when he couldn't get wine from France, he was crushed, you know.
So to speak,
yes.
So he's very enamored of French culture across the board, not just the food, including the wine, but all of French culture.
Yes. This is his first experience of Europe, of Enlightenment culture in Europe. Everything about France fascinates him. He just loves it. He loves the salons. He loves the dinner parties. He loves all of these intellectuals that he's rubbing shoulders with. He gets along extremely well with the aristocracy. Also, just the art. He's never seen art of this caliber before. He doesn't like Gothic architecture. He thinks it's too dark. But nonetheless, it's the first time he's ever seen a stained glass window, something that we would take for granted. So he's just mesmerized, and every place that he goes, it just seems to get better and better.
Here's the key to this, because he's not by himself. He's with his daughter, and he's with particularly his slave, James Hemmings, and he's made a grand bargain with him that if he will learn French cooking and then train someone back at home, he will give the slave, who is also his relative,
yeah,
his freedom.
Yes, that's
and,
correct.
And James Hemmings takes that deal. I'm talking with Thomas Crogwell, who lives in Bethel, Connecticut, and he's written this book, Thomas Jefferson's Creme Brulee. What is James Hemmings doing on the trip? What? Tell me about his story.
What he starts out is working for a caterer near Jefferson's house on the Champs-Élysées. The caterer was actually bringing the three meals a day to the Jeffersons. They hadn't had a cook yet. So he starts there. James speaks no French. The caterer and his staff speak no English. So it's complete immersion, which they always say is the best way to learn a language. And then James keeps graduating to more skillful chefs. And it's a three-year training process. And the third year, he wraps it up with the chef who cooks for the Prince of Condé. The prince is the brother of King Louis XVI. So his chef rivals what's going on at Versailles. It's like being trained by one of the Iron Chefs, you know, on the Food Network. And so James becomes this incredibly accomplished chef. And the very first dinner party Jefferson throws, where James is going to do the cooking, he invites his dearest friend, Maria Cosway, an English artist on whom he had a huge crush, and a whole bunch of princesses and barons and counts. He wants to show off James Hemmings and James Hemmings' skills. And apparently it was a flawless dinner and the beginning, the first of many.
The thing is, though, ingredients count for everything. And so if you go to France or Italy or another country, the ingredients there are different from the ingredients here. And so how did they pull that off?
Jefferson brought an awful lot of stuff that he knew he was never going to find in the U.S. Wheels of Parmesan cheese, casks of olive oil, boxes of truffles, and then trees for particular fruits that were not available in the United States. And he even brought along olive saplings, because he hoped that they could grow olives in South Carolina. Well, South Carolina's climate is not the climate of Provence, so that didn't work out. And he also bought grapevines. He was hoping to have a vineyard at Monticello. That didn't work either.
What happens to James Hemmings, his slave, when he comes back?
Well, there's a little bit of a disappointment, because when Jefferson arrived back in the United States, he discovered that George Washington had named him Secretary of State, and he was going to have to move to the U.S. Capitol, which was in New York at that time. Well, if he's now an important cabinet minister, or as they would say in Europe, an important member of the cabinet, he's going to have to do dinner parties. He needs a really good chef. So he doesn't free James. He takes him with him to New York. And apparently, at one point, James must have complained, because they were home for 4 years. He still hadn't been freed. He and Jefferson sign a contract together that James will start training the slave at Monticello and then Jefferson will free James. This is very unusual. I don't believe you're going to find anywhere else in American history where a master and a slave sat down and made a contract.
And that contract was written long after he had already promised to release him.
Yes.
How many years?
Nine.
And so that's when the contract was written?
Yes.
And the contract said, I will release you when?
After James had finished training the slave at Monticello.
And how long did that take?
1 year.
Okay, so it took 10 years for Thomas Jefferson to honor his promise to his slave, who was also his relative.
Right.
So perhaps the word somewhat disappointing is an understatement.
Just, yeah, you could say that. 10 years is a long time to wait for a deal to be...
Why didn't James convince Jefferson that he would just go ahead and train someone else to have all the knowledge he had, and then they'd be done?
Because James had absolutely no bargaining power whatsoever. Jefferson owned him absolutely, completely, the way you own a dog or a cat. It's a harsh comparison, but nonetheless, James had no freedom of action whatsoever.
I wonder why Jefferson changed his mind even after 9 years. He kept him for 9 additional years. What could he have said that finally convinced Thomas Jefferson to honor his own humanity?
I have no idea what the conversation was. That hasn't survived.
Yeah.
Reading between the lines, there appear to have been a certain closeness between Jefferson and James, that there was something approaching friendship, but nonetheless, it was still a master-slave relationship. So when it was in Jefferson's interest to be the master, he was.
I was wondering if it was the relative friendship connection that might have, you know, made something of their loyalty to one another. if there was loyalty to one another.
There was, and there, we see it from time to time in the exchanges between these two men.
But was that loyalty out of self-interest? What else was James Hemings in a position to do? He was owned.
Yes.
So was it real loyalty, or was it, this is what I've got to do to make my life while I'm owned by this man as good as it can be so that I get to stay in the house and not work in the fields,
right,
etc.?
That's possible. We do know that there were relationships between slaves and masters, slaves and mistresses, where there was real affection there and loyalty, but, you know, it's a complicated issue.
This is Thomas Crogwell. He lives in Bethel, Connecticut. He's written this book, Thomas Jefferson's Creme Brulee. It's about how one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, and his slave, James Hemings, who was also his relative, introduced French cuisine to America. What happened to James Hemings and the contract?
He trained his brother Peter as a chef, and when the training was done, Jefferson gave James his manumission papers, which he was probably going to need. You know, he could be stopped anywhere, and if he didn't have that document on him, he could have been sold back into slavery. And then James went off, and he worked as a caterer. And then he started working in what we would call restaurants, inns and taverns, oftentimes around Baltimore. And then Jefferson is elected president, and he needs a chef at the White House. And he sends a friend off to find James and offers him the post of chef at the White House. And James says to this guy, you know, I'd like to hear a couple of lines from Mr. Jefferson. And Jefferson never gets around to it for some reason. And James is kind of stung. So he doesn't take the offer. They don't hear from each other for a couple of years. When Jefferson was president, hard as this may be to believe, from the 1st of June until the last of September, he left Washington. He went back to Monticello. He did no government work. And on one of these occasions, he did write to James, and he invited him to come back to Monticello and be his cook for the summer vacation. And James did. And apparently, they liked being together.
But it was as employer and employee.
Yes, as employer and employee. And then Jefferson went back to D.C., and James went back to his job in Baltimore, and that was the last time they saw each other.
Yes, so much for the friendship. Did Jefferson succeed, you know, through his power and office to truly introduce French food in America? Did it take off because Jefferson was doing it?
Well, you know, he did introduce all of these French recipes, including what we would call French fries and macaroni and cheese. I found diary entries from some of the dinner guests at the White House who talked about Mr. Jefferson's macaroni pie. And some of them liked it and some of them didn't. It might have been the Parmesan cheese. It might have been too sharp for the American palate. He started all of his parties with champagne. So that it created the idea.
A buzz.
Yes. You know, the Americans said, oh, well, it's a festive occasion. You have to have champagne. There was this kitchen wizardry of a puff pastry comes hot to the table, and inside it is perfect vanilla ice cream that hasn't melted. How did they pull that off? You know, this is the introduction. Unfortunately, Americans believed that fancy food was sinful, that virtuous Americans ate simple food.
Puritanism.
Puritanism. Puritanism at the table. And so the introduction, even though it was interesting to the people in Washington and elsewhere, what Jefferson was doing, it stalled. It really didn't get down into the middle classes.
What I find interesting is that when Mr. Cheney and Mr. Bush were in the White House, they started a campaign against France and its culture. I wonder if they knew in doing so they were letting down one of the founding fathers.
I suspect that they didn't know that. I think they were just ticked off at France.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Frank.
Thomas.
Thanks for the invitation.
You're welcome. Thomas Crogwell, who is author of this book, Thomas Jefferson's Creme Brulee. This is a story of how the founding father and his slave, James Hemings, who was also his relative, introduced French cuisine to America. The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on WNPR. Check out our guest lineup and join the conversation with us and other listeners on Facebook. Just search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to our talented team, producer Jonathan McNichol and senior producer Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.